Get past the people, get past the hitman.
The Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Monday's with Sandy Williams. So, Sandy, the economy. We've been talking about the economy. Interest rate 5.25, and the feds want to raise it even more. And they have certainly... Inflation has certainly leveled off somewhat, safe to say that. It's still at far too high, but it over the last several months, it has leveled off, right?
Well, yeah, core inflation is down into the 5-6 range, core being the non-commodity parts of inflation, so not gasoline, not food per se. But the things that matter to people, obviously, are gasoline and food. So the fact that those are have come down are good for Tom, Dick, and Mary. And, you know, there are some who believe that this current uncharted water that we're in, which is interest rates going up, employment, however, unemployment going down at the same time or remaining static, is sort of defying what economists have normally thought would happen when they use the interest rate tool. They think that they're going to be able to fiddle with unemployment, that unemployment will go up gradually, and that they can therefore measure that as the tool that demonstrates that inflation is not going to happen. Like I've said before, inflation is a psychology, and I wish people, when they talked about this, would simplify it so that the public could understand what's going on. Yeah, the economists and the pundits who talk about the economy. And they don't maybe even understand it themselves, that inflation is caused by people believing that prices are going to go up, so they buy it today instead of waiting for tomorrow. And by buying for today, they create a bidding situation that bids the prices up today, inflation. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If the public thinks inflation is going to happen, it's going to happen. And Larry Summers was on last week talking about this, and he had something to say that's a lot along the lines of what I've said, which is that because it's a psychology, it's a bit like when we were talking about the COVID epidemic and vaccinations. And people thought vaccinations, as long as they thought vaccinations could control COVID, they were going to go out and get vaccinated. But when it became clear that you could still get COVID and be vaccinated, and when COVID, we had a second wave of COVID, then the public's fear of COVID went way up. And the trust they had in vaccination went way down, and that's what would happen if inflation comes back now. So inflation has been going down. If it starts coming back again in any sort of resurgence, the American public could well believe, you know what, we are in an inflationary world. The prices are going to go up. I do need to buy this car today. I do need to spend my money today. And even though interest rates are going up, we're going to undertake that higher interest rate in order to get this thing, because if the price is going to go up faster than the interest rate that I'm charged is charging me, I might still buy it. And that's what happened in the 70s when interest rates went all the way up to 15 and 18%, which was clearly runaway inflation. And so we don't want that to happen. But on the other hand, we also don't want policies to be adopted that are premised on the fact that we can't let Tom, Dick, and Mary earn more money, because Tom, Dick, and Mary have been saddled with static wages for the last 40 years, and that's one of the reasons why our middle class has evaporated, because too many of the jobs in our economy don't pay living wages.
So, Sandy, let me ask you, because part of all of this was the supply chain. Is that still a problem?
Supply chain is loosening up. You know, the cars are getting back to being able to be produced at their normal level. You know, it takes a while to adjust the supply chain. Now, interestingly, everyone who thought that imposing tariffs on China and disrupting the supply chain in that fashion would force jobs back into America has to rethink that, because it turns out that still almost the same percentage of parts that were made abroad are still made abroad. They just aren't made in China. They're made in other countries. But we didn't bring back and onshore everything that could have been brought onshore, because we live in a competitive world. We live in a world of competitive prices. We live in a world of competitive employment opportunities and specializations. There are other places in the world where people who want to manufacture something can assemble capable workers very quickly and build facilities which will be online very quickly and not in America.
So, Sandy, we've been in this area now with the supply chain and inflation and other things now, it's safe to say, for several years. And so we still have this, as the Federal Reserve says, they still want to raise interest rates. They're not satisfied with what they're seeing. They think that they still have to, you know, make this adjustment a couple more times.
Well, I think they're doing that to make sure that they can tamp down. They're playing whack-a-mole with this inflation psychology, and they want anyone who's thinking that there might still be an underlying inflationary pressure in the economy to believe that the Fed is going to play whack-a-mole on inflation as they have to tamp it down. So they're going to talk about interest rate rises. They're talking about 0.25% interest rate rises.
Right, as opposed to the three quarters.
Talking about much smaller ones. They're basically just feeding the thought processes in the financial world and in the world generally the notion that we're not going to allow inflation to happen in America as a way to try and tamp down inflation psychology and let people, if people believe it, that we aren't going to have inflation, we won't have inflation.
But the more they do that, Sandy, aren't they lighting the wick that eventually is going to blow up in the way of
a recession? Well, that's why they worry about, that's why this whole soft landing concept. We very rarely have soft landings. And today I heard people talking, a foolish reporter for the Wall Street Journal on the radio podcast today was saying that there are some who believe that we have to have a recession in order to cure inflation. And I'm not sure that's true in today's world with...
He's not alone, though.
No,
that's his way of thinking.
No, there's plenty of people who think that we're going to have to certainly flirt with recession. We've been flirting with recession as soon as we started raising interest rates by 0.75%. And in fact, I think economists are scratching their head and wondering why we haven't had the recession yet and why didn't the rate of employment go down. But they didn't understand the impact that the pandemic had in the several ways that it had it. One, the pandemic bottled up demand. When we had shortages, we couldn't buy things. We bid up the price to the extent we did, but we also ended up with a bottled up demand for things. People deferred buying cars, then when cars became available, they started buying them again. And the price of used cars has gone up again a little bit in the last couple of weeks. That bottled up demand is now gone away because the pandemic has been over for a while. So we don't have that pressure anymore. The pressure on inflation that was caused by the supply chain is gone away. We still have shortages in some areas. We have shortage issues in the world of oil based on the Ukraine situation. We have shortages in food commodities also related to some world events. So we have shortage-driven issues that can involve inflation, but the underlying pressures that would create inflation might not be there. And so my hope, actually I'm fairly optimistic. Larry Summers, who's not often very optimistic, said he was much more optimistic about the soft landing potential in the current environment where employment was not falling off rapidly and inflation was going down. And the question is whether there begins to be a resurgence of inflation. And I would agree that a resurgence of inflation will be doubly dangerous because that could change psychology. I think what we learned so far is that inflation psychology is not embedded in us, and we've all become used to a world in which there isn't inflation, and we think normalcy will return us to that world.
All right, let's go to the phone lines, and Bill from O'Connor, Milwaukee. Hey, Bill, thank you very much for the call. You say what?
I'd like to address this to Sandy. Boy, I couldn't agree with you more. I was amazed that the minute Biden took office, Fox started screaming. I mean, screaming recession. And I thought, we're not in a recession, really in a serious recession. They kept saying, pretty soon the millions of listeners that listen to them believed we are in recession. And Sandy alluded to that fact that you can be convinced you're in a recession. Now, we didn't need, excuse me for the dog. I have a dog that's complaining.
Your dog can talk just about, Bill. What's he saying? Put him on the line.
I thought that was a baby. Go ahead.
Actually, he's disagreeing with me. I debate with a dog when I don't debate with you guys. But anyhow, getting back to what we were talking about, also with Sandy touched on the virus. And, you know, they thought the vaccine was no good because people got COVID. Yes, they did, but they didn't die from it. It was the media has controlled way too much. Look how they destroyed Fauci. I can't forgive those people for that. I just can't. That was horrible. And the same thing with this recession. Yes, we needed a correction. I invest a lot in myself. That's how I support myself. We needed a correction. And it was long coming, but it wasn't as serious as Fox made it out to be. The media just impacts us way too much. What do you think, Sandy?
Well, I do. I think the sky is.
Thank you, Bill.
I think the sky is falling sells news, and it makes people watch. And so it's much, much better to cry out about disasters than it is to applaud successful events. And that was what Donald Trump rode the horse on for 4 years. He was finding one disaster, one horrible thing after another to scare the people about. And the only thing that's good about persuading people that there's a recession is that it helps them understand that inflation is not embedded in the economy. So that the people, I mean, I think people have not shared in prosperity, okay? People have not felt wealthier. Many people, even though wealth was increased in the United States, it was not a shared prosperity where lots of people experienced it. Some people experienced it who owned homes, and that's why we had this instantaneous fly up. I think we have a break.
Yeah, gotta go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Show as always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Monday. That's Monday with Sandy Williams. We haven't talked about the economy for some time now, Sandy, and I can't help but think about the fallout if recession does hit, the impact that it's going to have. I asked you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, off the air, we were talking about this too, and you and I have always talked about, and I've agreed with you that recessions are inevitable. But it's been about 15 years, I think, since we've had an officially declared recession, and that's a very long time. Maybe the longest we've had since essentially
that I can recall.
Watch this kind of stuff since World War II, but. It might be a very long time between recessions. Recessions, I think, probably do require there to be significant rises in unemployment for the economy to experience the kind of depressed effect that a recession creates. And recession is a technical term, but the agreement on what constitutes a recession has never really been squared. So frequently people talk about two successive quarters in which GDP doesn't rise, it falls, but maybe that isn't a recession. And other people have said, well, that isn't really a recession. It has to relate to unemployment. What happened during this last pandemic was that I think that businesses at large realized the fundamental importance of human capital And I think we had, for the last 30 or 40 years, diminished in the business world and in the business model the importance of human capital. I think business people began to think of workers like ants, and all they have to do when the recession's over is put out more sugar and they'll attract more ants. And that's not what happened after the pandemic. When the pandemic lifted or began to lift and they began to get back to trying to go full bore and produce things, they found out they had to leave lots of money on the table because they couldn't make cars. They couldn't make all these things that they wanted to make. They couldn't landscape your yard. They couldn't fix your HVAC system because they didn't have the workers to do it. So there's been a great deal of reluctance in this current economic experience to lay off people. And the only sector that's been laying off people has been the high-tech sector, which everyone viewed as being, number one, not representative of American workers at large, and number two, a sector that had brought people on at a profligate rate during the last 10 years.
You know, Sandy, recessions only kind of affected manufacturing. I mean, you know, if you work for the government, recession didn't impact you.
Right.
If you worked, you know, in service areas for the most part, recession didn't affect you. Mainly manufacturing, right?
Manufacturing was the main space. And if you look at today's economy, healthcare, okay, recession is not going to damage the healthcare sector. The sector that's devoted to the military-industrial complex, well, unfortunately, that's not going to be affected. It's booming in the current situation, okay? And then we've got local service providers, HVAC, all the kind of things that are local service restaurants. Restaurants used to be affected by recession and would be because disposable income goes down and discretionary expenditures tend to go down. Recessions affect the purchases of durable goods. So if you're going to buy fewer washers and dryers and TVs and things that last for a while. But as long as people are employed, well, the other thing about our economy is we don't have a lot of people with surplus money. And so, you know, we've got a much bigger part of our economy living paycheck to paycheck. As long as they're employed, they're going to be okay living paycheck to paycheck. If they get, but it's not going to be inflationary for them to continue to be employed because there's a limit to how much they can bid up the prices of things. So our economy is more recession-proof than it used to be, significantly more recession-proof. And then the question is whether we can keep it an inflation-proof and recession-proof.
So what changed from 2008 when we had the last recession to now that has made it more recession-proof?
Well, the 2008 recession was a financial collapse. And when money dried up, it dried up everywhere. And people were at risk of essentially insolvency. When you're at the risk of insolvency, you know, it's like having a gangrene on your lower leg.
You cut it off,
and then you save yourself. So that's kind of what was going on at that point. Our economy had gangrene, and it was trying to...
And that was because of the housing.
It was started out with a housing thing, but it bled over into the whole financial world. And lots of financial institutions were tested at the very edge of their viability.
And so did we then put in systems that would prevent that from ever happening again? Supposedly, I thought.
Well, the Fed established much tougher tests for banks. Now the banks are heavily involved with trying to lobby against those and say, look, we don't need these anymore. It was kind of like what they did when they said, we don't need Glass-Steagall anymore. And then when the banks were allowed to open up their investment portfolios into everything, they began to invest in things that essentially led to the 2008 collapse. And so the problem with our regulatory process is its memory, okay? So my hope is that its memory is long enough that if we protect our financial, the central financial operations in this country, we can withstand a lot of other things because of the way our economy is currently built if what I've described continues, which is a respect for human capital.
So hold the thought. Got to go to a break. I see you, CJ. We'll come to you after the break. 844-967-2789. It's Monday. It's Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. It's Monday, and that means Mondays with Sandy Williams, my co-host. 844-967-2789 is the number. Let's go to the phone lines and CJ. CJ, what's going on there?
Yes, thank you, Sandy and Earl, for taking my call. Just a couple of points. Inflation hurts lower-income people hardest. It hits them hardest. And Sandy spoke of Larry Summers. Inflation when President Joe Biden took office was 1.4. Larry Summers warned. Right, Sandy? He said, don't spend the $2 trillion because you're going to cause inflation. And it went up to a record 40-year high. It's still at 6.9. And it was caused by this president.
Hey, CJ, hold on a second. CJ, hold on a second. Wasn't Donald Trump warned about giving tax breaks at the time that he gave the tax breaks? Wasn't he warned? Did he do it anyway?
What does that have to do with what we're speaking of, Earl? You want to change the subject now?
No.
Inflation is at a record high.
Well, CJ,
this president caused it. He was warned by Larry Summers.
CJ, hold on, CJ.
CJ, hold on.
Put him on hold.
CJ, well, first, let's just go through a couple of things here. One, the root cause of this inflation is manifold. Yes, the government has been busily priming the economy in this country for well over a decade. Because we were in a state of financial collapse in 2008, the economy badly needed to be propped up and saved, quite
frankly. Did Donald Trump, part of that priming?
So through the Obama administration, there continued to be priming, right. and the economy began to move in the direction of thriving. And by the time Donald Trump became president, the economy, in fact, was thriving. The amount of growth that occurred under every form of measurement of growth and prosperity grew more under the Obama period than it did under the Trump period. And the last 4 years of Obama had better numbers than the 4 years of Donald Trump. Donald Trump received a thriving economy, in fact, a booming economy, and threw gasoline on the fire with the tax reduction. The tax reduction was not a bipartisan act, and it passed. We get to the Biden period, and we have the pandemic recession, and a belief that was bipartisan that there needed to be a great deal of priming. So, beginning with the Trump period in the White House, the priming of the federal economy in response to the pandemic began, and the act which passed. The Infrastructure Act, which I think you're referring to for the Trump administration, the Infrastructure Act was in fact a bipartisan bill that passed. Now, you know, did all of that government spending contribute to inflation? Yes, but the trigger cause of inflation was shortages. The pandemic created supply chain problems, which were obviously also contributed to by the tariffs that were enacted under the Trump administration that gummed up the supply chain that was derived from China, which incidentally was the biggest component of the foreign parts supplies for American manufacturing. And so it was shortages, massive shortages that were created by the supply chain as well as by the Ukrainian conflict. And I know you'll jump in and say that the Ukrainian conflict was Joe Biden's problem, but the issues associated with inflation are nowhere near as black and white as you would paint them. And quite frankly, the prior administration and administrations had every bit as much to do with setting the table. And the tax deduction, which was very material, which was enacted during the Trump administration, had a massive effect both on government deficits beginning in the next year, as well as setting the table for inflation. But I think every economist would agree that this inflation, to the extent that anyone would point at it and give it a root cause, would say that it was driven by shortages. And I know what Larry I know what Larry Summers said. The reason, one of the reasons I was quoting Larry Summers today was the fact that I knew you were probably listening and would want to quote Larry Summers from a couple of years ago. But Larry Summers is now believing that that a soft landing is altogether likely, and he also thinks that that inflation might have been nipped in the bud. He shares my concern that we don't want to see inflation reappear because it would potentially affect the national view of and the market's view of whether we have embedded inflation. So I just think we ought to not simplify things and to the point of being able to argue over them quite so vehemently, because I think particularly the economy is a much more complex process than you would certainly describe it as.
All right, CJ.
Well, he failed to recognize, Sandy, the 1.4 when this president took office, Larry Summers warned record high inflation.
No, wait.
If you're trying to buy a house, or buy a car, mm-hmm. or buy anything, groceries, look at what eggs are now. Yeah.
CJ. CJ, just let's not be silly about things. The avian flu is the source of the egg price, okay?
The
farmers have been killing their hens by the millions, the tens of millions. And we have an immense shortage of eggs that has been caused by the avian flu. And to point at the president and say that egg prices are his fault is kind of a silly thing to do. Now, yes, we had 1.4% inflation. We also had a pandemic recession that had driven inflation down from what it was even a year prior to that. 1.4 was a record low. And the reason that we didn't experience inflation more rapidly after the tax reduction was the fact that it was followed on its heels by the pandemic, which created essentially a recession condition in the economy.
Let's do this. Let's go to Frank from Poinette. Thank you very much for the call, Frank. You say what?
Well, I appreciate everything you guys do, but I just have one question. With all this stuff that's going on, it's more complicated than most of us get, but I understand back in the day there's been past presidents that did the price freeze on stuff, and I just wonder how that would kind of turned out this time and age, or what was that all about? You know what I'm talking about?
What the price? Tell me what price freeze you're talking about, the one in the Nixon administration, the price controls?
Yeah, stuff like that. Why wasn't that ever considered or anything at this time and age?
Well, I think that price controls, you know, in World War II, we had books and we had to buy things with, I'm trying to remember the name of the stamp-like things that were...
The green stamps?
Yeah, well, they were distributed so that instead of using money, we were using allotments for food because... Everyone knew that the war and the shortages created by the war would create massive inflation, and so they controlled it. And price controls in the 70s were viewed by economists as a horrendous mistake, and they created a real problem, bottled up demand that probably led in some respects to the inflation which occurred then in the late 70s. So why didn't we talk about it? I think it was a failed policy in the past, and we weren't going to get all the way to having restrictions like we experience in wartime to control it.
Huh. It just seems like to me that this inflation business is all coming from the top corporations. They're just charging what they want. It ain't got nothing to do with the deficit or anything else.
Well, I think that one of the problems with commodities is the way the pricing occurs at the margin, and that's why in the commodity business, even though the long-term margins are not that great, the margins in the period of price upswings can be very high, and that was proven with the oil and gas industry making record profits during this fly-up in price caused by the shortage of worldwide oil And yes, the price of gasoline became very high to the refineries because of the restriction on supply and their ability to demand higher prices and receive them. But if you look at the long-term profit margin earned by those industries, it isn't as great. And the ability to control prices in a market economy is kind of hard, you know?
You know, Sandy, and thank you very much for the call, Frank. You know, Sandy, it does. Frank makes me think, as you go in the grocery store and the price of groceries continuing to remain high, and then you look at the packaging where the prices have remained high, but now those corporations, the packages and the amount of food that you actually get has been reduced. And that's going to be reduced. It's not like once things get back to normal, those things are going to get back to where they normally were. I don't care what it is you buy. You look at the packages, and you're getting less than you were getting before all of this started, and you're paying a much higher price. You're not getting as much food as you once did. That's not going to go back. And so that higher price that people pay for that commodity called food, Sandy, that's not going to change.
Well, you know, that's why we need to have a Department of Justice that polices monopolies, because what's supposed to control that in a market economy is competition. If someone starts skimping on the size of the packaging that they're selling you candy bars in, then somebody else would come along and say, you know what, don't buy their skimpy candy bar, buy my candy bar. I'm still giving you 6 ounces of candy for the price of 6 ounces of candy.
Right.
Competition is supposed to control that. But I'm afraid that the laxity of the American regulation for monopoly, the whole market regulation for market control, has been so lax that most of the American products that we buy, for instance, in the supermarket,
right,
are controlled by a limited number of suppliers who are in a position to do this carry out this kind of conduct and make the day with it.
Sandy, we can't watch that, though. We're expecting somebody else to watch that, right? I mean, in this capitalistic system, that's part of it, right? That's the reason they have those people in place, so that we don't get what we're getting now. People know that they're getting less, right? If you can talk to anybody who's in grocery stores.
Yeah, I mean, the American competitive marketplace is sort of failing in these periods, and it's demonstrated to us by the circumstance you're describing, where it appears that there's enough market control held by people selling us stuff that they can gouge us in this manner rather quickly. And commodities are a little different. Commodities, where they get in short supply, get priced at the margin, and this is what happens. But general foodstuffs and they should be subject to competition. And unfortunately, as you can see, for instance, the number of supermarket chain owners in this country has diminished down to a handful. And either you have a locally owned store or you have one of the national chains. And I just looked up the thing I was thinking about during World War II were called ration stamps. Okay?
Oh, yes.
And the world in the United States, much of the world lived under what is called rationing, so that things were rationed so that they weren't priced by a marketplace. You just got so many gallons of milk a week, and that's all
right.
You could get. And so we aren't going to go to that kind of extreme. And so then we have to depend on the marketplace to help us. And the marketplace in the United States hasn't been adequately policed ever since, really, the period of Reagan.
So the marketplace,
Department of Justice stopped enforcing antitrust laws.
So that's broken, Sandy. So who's gonna change that? How do you ever get back? Isn't that the politician's responsibility to oversee that?
Yes, it is. And the government is failing us, and this is all part of this anti-regulation movement. One of the things that is beneficial to businesses at large is a good policing of antitrust laws, because businesses are the ones who are victims of market. To the extent that you aren't the business that has.
to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789 is the number. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That's Mondays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, we were talking again off the air. And it's, to me, Sandy, I think we should expect more. When you say the regulatory process is not working, I just can't accept that it's not working. At some point in time, somebody's got to be responsible for fixing it. As many times as I talk with people standing in the line in the grocery stores, and they say, look at this. They'll pull, even if it's a can, Sandy, of corned beef hash, and they'll pull a can out, and it looks like, well, this is a bit of an exaggeration, the cans that used to go with the dollar houses back in the day.
The can of soup that now looks like a can of tuna.
Yeah, you've seen them.
Yeah.
So when can we expect that to, is that ever going to get fixed?
Well, you know, this is part of what Tom describes as the problem of money and politics. I can only ascribe the fact that the antitrust enforcement has gone to sleep in Washington to the fact that big money has come to affect our public policy, because, of course, big companies are the ones that have market control, and they're the ones who can feed the most money into politics, and I presume it's big corporations, therefore, that have a great deal of sway. And it's really, the victims of this are not just consuming America, it's also all of the other smaller businesses in America that get the short end of the stick with respect to their ability to compete. And, you know, one of the examples of this, I'm not sure the beer industry has suffered the price problem, but yet in the ads in this Super Bowl, you notice that they combined the ads of Coors, Miller Lite, and Blue Moon into one ad. And that's because all three of those brands are now owned by one company, okay? And in my day, in the 70s and
80s. Budweiser.
No, they're not owned by Budweiser.
No, I was wondering what happened. I didn't see any Budweiser
commercials. Well, there weren't any Budweiser ads, but Budweiser isn't owned by an American company either. So all of the major brands have been consolidated down to, I think, three major owners. And I think all of them are foreign, offshore owners. And the number of brands that are now controlled by single owners is unbelievably large. So the affiliate brands of Miller are all kinds of brands that you can imagine.
So, Sandy, if we don't at some point in time get a hold on this, I always talk about grandchildren and great-grandchildren. You and I will be able to, you know, through the remainder of our lives, this is not going to be a death knell for us. But at the rate this thing is going, Sandy, who's going to bring it back into where it needs counterbalance?
Well, I think Tom is right. Until we get money out of politics, we're going to have trouble getting balance back into the system. And one of the things that the American system absolutely requires, and it is, like I said, the golden goose, is sound regulation of the marketplaces, sound regulation of the financial markets, sound regulation of our food and drug areas. Those are all things that put the stamp of approval and the good housekeeping stamp of approval on American products, on the American financial markets. All the things that put America into leadership positions in the world are in many respects premised on the sound regulation from our government. And if we're going to throw that out, we are going to choke the golden goose.
Well, you know, Sandy, we have thrown it out. And it's why, you know, it might sound like at times when I'm on the air that I'm always being critical of our government. But Sandy, for heaven's sakes, you know, when regulation can be bought off, regulation that is there to protect the people, then you know, and we say, well, money in politics, it's a long shot to turn that around, because the American people aren't focused on money and politics, Sandy, for the most part. Not enough of us.
Yeah.
And they're continuing to get the short end of the stick. At some point in time, you know, this is not going to go well.
Well, and the problem is that the knee-jerk reaction of most societies where government gets paralyzed is to install an autocracy. And I guarantee you the one thing that doesn't work in autocracies is regulation. Regulation is then directly for sale and directly under the control of one person. No, what we need to do is like Tom said, we need to get money out of politics.
How do you do that?
We got to get people power back. Well, we got to start with Citizens United. I think the combining all of the energy and political force necessary to reverse Citizens United would only come in the circumstance when a great deal of the electorate is awakened to and is willing to fight about money in politics. And if we get to that point, we will be a long way down the road towards solving the problem. And if we solve the problem, then I think there's a great deal of hope. If we don't solve the problem, then I think, you know, we're going to, the American political system is paralyzed and failing. And the American regulatory governmental process is in the process of beginning to fail. You know, the Federal Aeronautics Agency has failed in the regulation of safety for airplanes with Boeing. We saw that happen. The Food and Drug Administration is being brought to task much more frequently about the things they regulate, including meatpacking and industries
as
drugs.
When I hear you say that, I know it's true. But the inherent danger in that is what's always talked about, America imploding from the inside.
Well, we need to get politicians willing to talk about this in a way that is both easy to understand and compelling. And I think people better explain it. I mean, I think that the broad brush sweep of the hand talk that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders use probably isn't sufficient because it sounds radical. I think what we have to do is bring things down to earth and make it reach the actual thought processes of day-to-day life for Tom, Dick, and Mary, like the food we eat, like the drugs we take, like
the water we
drink, the planes we fly in,
right,
like the water we drink, like the stock we buy on the stock market. All of these things are necessarily going to be improved by sound regulation from the government. And we better have sound government to assure us of that.
We're going to leave it there. That's Sandy Williams. He'll be back on Friday. Sandy, thank you as always. Thank everybody who made the show go. I'll be back on tomorrow. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.